Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the important role that Florida played in the American Revolution is often overlooked.
They became so incensed that they made effigies of John Hancock and Samuel Adams and hung them in the trees in the St. Augustine Plaza and set them on fire. And this colony was adamantly loyal when the war broke out.
We'll discuss Florida as a borderland to other European colonies.
The politics of empire, whether Spanish or British, required those who called East Florida home to reassess their status within the politics of new regimes, develop new strategies of negotiation, and navigate the internal politics of their communities and tribes.
And the Clearwater Lawn Bowling Club is 100 years old. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
50 nifty United States from 13 original colonies. 50 nifty stars in the flag that billows so beautifully in the breeze.
The so-called 13 original colonies that would lead to the creation of the United States exclude the 14th and 15th colonies of East Florida and West Florida. St. Augustine, Florida was an active city for more than four decades before the English established a settlement at Jamestown, Virginia in 1607. The Spanish gave Florida its name in 1513 and established the first continuously occupied European settlement in what would become the United States in 1565. After two centuries under Spanish occupation, the British took control of Florida in 1763. The British separated the area into East Florida with its capital in St. Augustine and West Florida with its capital in Pensacola. Under British rule, East Florida consisted of what is the modern boundary of the state east of the Apalachicola River. West Florida included the modern panhandle of Florida, as well as parts of what are now Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Roger Smith focused his doctoral studies at the University of Florida on the topic of Florida in the American Revolution. Smith says that for the first 11 years of occupation, the British colonists in Florida had difficulties with the Seminole Indians.
In 1774, Governor Patrick Tonin arrived, and the very first thing he did in literally 2 weeks' time was call a Congress with Cowkeeper, and they instantly became friends and allies, and it was more than just political. Cowkeeper absolutely respected Tonin and trusted him at his word. And there was where the relationship got built, so that as the revolution approached, the Seminoles truly became allies as opposed to people who would be considered someone just causing problems and so production agricultural production began to blossom. The other thing that Tonin did was he built two rowboats that were so large, the only way I can describe them is they're like 18th century tugs. And they would literally, if they couldn't tug in a large sloop over the notorious bar there, a sandbar there in St. Augustine, they would row out to the across the bar and unload ships there and bring it into the harbor. So for the first time, a decent amount of trade was actually coming and going from St. Augustine. And so the colony actually began to prosper. And so when 1776 came along, and on August 11th, when news of the Declaration of Independence became known in St. Augustine, the people were kind of like, you want us to do what? We just started making money. And now they became so incensed that they made effigies of John Hancock and Samuel Adams and hung them in the trees in the St. Augustine Plaza and set them on fire. This colony was adamantly loyal when the war broke out.
At the start of the American Revolution in 1776, East Florida and West Florida were the only two southern colonies that remained loyal to King George III. This was a problem for the British, as the southern colonies in North America supplied food, clothing, and other supplies to their sugar plantations in the Caribbean.
We always look at the American Revolution from an American perspective. 13 colonies from New Hampshire down to Georgia, and we've always been told that nothing happened in the South until 1780 when Mel Gibson came along and won the war single-handedly. Actually, when I looked at the war from a British perspective, my first question was, what maps were they looking at back then? And when you do that, you realize we're not talking about 13 colonies, we're talking about 33 colonies that they had to be concerned with from Nova Scotia down to Grenada. Half of those colonies, 16 of them, were in the Caribbean. And approximately 60% of the British military during the American Revolution was stationed in the Caribbean, not up where the fighting was, but down where sugar was being produced, because sugar was the equivalent in global economics of crude oil today. It's what afforded empire. And the British, when you read their primary documents, you realize they had one primary goal, to not lose a square inch of soil in the Caribbean to the Spanish, Dutch, or French. Priority number two was to reclaim the American South, because by September of 1775, every southern colony between the Chesapeake Bay and the St. Mary's River had fallen to the rebellion. Only East and West Florida remained loyal.
The Floridas were located right between the British sugar plantations in the Caribbean and the Northern Colonial Revolt. The British launched attacks on the American Rebellion from both St. Augustine in East Florida and Pensacola in West Florida. St. Augustine was particularly important to the British, as it had the only stone fortresses south of the Chesapeake Bay. The British had repeatedly attacked the Castillo de San Marcos when it was under Spanish control and realized the strength of its coquina walls.
And the British understood that the waterways, the seas, they weren't barriers. That's how you got places faster. And in 1765, when the stamp tax revolt broke out, there were Sons of Liberty riots in Nevis and St. Kitts. So they understood that all this momentum of rebellion and sedition had to do was hit the water and start right out into the Caribbean and into the Southern Atlantic. And they saw St. Augustine particularly, because it had the only pair of stone fortresses south of the Chesapeake Bay. They saw East and West Florida as barriers to sedition from rolling out into the Caribbean, and then launching pads for regaining the American South.
Although the importance of Florida in the American Revolution is usually ignored in history books, George Washington was well aware of the area's strategic significance. Washington wrote more than 80 letters about the Florida colonies to the Continental Congress and his generals, and he authorized 5 separate invasions of East Florida between 1776 and 1780.
You get into the George Washington papers, and in 1775, in December 18th of 75, he writes John Hancock, the president of the Continental Congress, and says, "We've intercepted a packet of letters bound for the Caribbean and St. Augustine. The British are stockpiling arms and munitions in the castle and barracks in St. Augustine." And Washington called for an army of militia to be authorized by Congress from Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. Congress became so alarmed that on January 1st of 1776, they said, we're gonna make sure you get your militia army, and we're also gonna add to that Continental regulars from North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. So this is no border skirmish. And it was the first of 5 invasions that Washington called for and Congress authorized on East Florida. So he fully understood the significance of East Florida and its potential role in the American Revolution.
Since East Florida remained under British rule during the American Revolution, it became a haven for British loyalists who moved there from the rebellion in the northern colonies. As Roger Smith explains, this actually allowed for East Florida to thrive.
As far as a British colony was concerned, that was the best thing that happened to East Florida, because it was a small colony when the war broke out. There was approximately 3,500 people, and the majority of them were slaves. By 1778, there was a population of over 10,000. And now there were enough people and sadly slave population to get the colony to where it was producing enough to where they not only were fulfilling the needs of the colony itself, but they were picking up the slack in the Caribbean for the foodstuffs and the flax for clothing and things that fed and clothed the slave population that produced the sugar. So the embargo that the Continental Congress actually called upon for trade against the British West Indies ended up falling, being a moot point because East Florida literally picked up about 80% of the slack and kept the Caribbean afloat in that regard.
During a series of battles from 1779 to 1781, Spain was able to recapture West Florida from the British. When the American Revolution ended in 1783, England returned East Florida to the Spanish to keep control of Gibraltar.
For these people down here, it was tragic because the majority of them believed that they had earned the right, just as the Canadians had, to remain a British colony here in North America. They had fought, they had fended off invasions, they had participated in the invasion of Georgia, and then on into Charleston. But the bottom line was the Spanish wanted Gibraltar. And the British basically took the stance of, you tried twice during the war and you failed. We're not going to give it up at the treaty and here at a table. So you better come up with something else. And the Spanish said, fine, we've already taken West Florida, let us keep that and we'll take East Florida. And the British said, fine. It came down to economics again, because Gibraltar was so pivotal in controlling the flow of trade in and out of the Caribbean, and the British weren't willing to give that up. But these poor people down here who had fought and bled and set up new lives and thought that they had found, kind of their forever home, were basically traded back like pawns. And it didn't go well. There was a lot of resentment down here.
Florida would become a United States territory in 1821 and was named a state in 1845. During the Civil War, Florida seceded from the Union, which is probably why its role in the American Revolution has been minimized.
You see, during the Civil War, not a lot of history produced, and a lot of writing, not a lot of scholastic work makes sense. You get into Reconstruction and the Northern industrialists are now looking back to their trading partners and in Europe and saying, okay, let's get things going again. And they basically look at us and say, gee, you guys kind of imploded here and you haven't been around that long, And it was like, no, we're 13 United Colonies. That was nothing but a hiccup. And now he says, we actually have professional historians for the first time in our country's history. Because it wasn't until the early 1880s that you could get a PhD in history. So they basically said, it's time to write official histories of the beginnings of our country in the American Revolution. And let's look at which universities had history departments to do that. The Southern schools were all but wiped out, and they were in existence, but their population, their student populations were so decimated. So who was writing that history? Well, it was the University of Chicago and Northwestern and the Ivy Leagues and the Northern schools. And it was not an era of political correctness. They took the opportunity to get their own little bit of vengeance on the South, and they basically wrote the Southern colonies out of the first 5 years of the American Revolution.
Dr. Roger Smith is author of The 14th Colony, The American Revolution's Best Kept Secret, and other books. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series Florida Frontiers and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
I'm out on the border. Whoa.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, in the second half of the 18th century, Florida changed hands twice, shifting from Spanish to British control at the end of the French and Indian War in 1763, and back to Spanish control in 1784, following the Peace of Paris that concluded the American Revolution. The Spanish and British had very different expectations for Florida and the indigenous people who lived there.
In a fall 2015 Florida Historical Quarterly article titled Reconstructing Power in an American Borderland, Nancy O. Gallman, at the time a Ph.D. candidate at the University of California, Davis, navigated the complexities of the two transitions in power in to provide a compelling interpretation of the barriers and opportunities for settlers, enslaved people, and indigenous tribes. The politics of empire, whether Spanish or British, required those who called East Florida home to reassess their status within the politics of new regimes, develop new strategies of negotiation, and navigate the internal politics of their communities and tribes. As Gallman argues, the several transitions of empire reshaped the politics of Florida in ways that shaped the peninsula well into the 19th century. According to Gallman, Spain and Great Britain shared two goals in their colonization efforts in North America. Quote, they wanted to expand the extent of their power and wealth and to establish a colonial social order which they would define and control, end quote. However, neither empire had free rein in achieving their goals. At the beginning of the 18th century, indigenous people outnumbered Europeans in the southeast by 10 to 1. In East Florida in 1775, the Creek population was five times that of the European. As a result, negotiations between Europeans and native populations took place on native ground, with indigenous people, quote, controlling much of the context and the terms of negotiation. Although both European powers shared some common goals, they differed considerably in what colonization meant in practical terms. Gallman explained that, quote, Spain struggled to assert its sovereignty over the Florida colony, end quote, but needed the peninsula to, quote, claim control over the Gulf economy and to protect the Spanish treasure fleet from rival attacks as it traveled between the Caribbean and Europe, end quote. Spain established few settlements in Florida and valued native people as, quote, potential spiritual converts and as allies in the defense of East Florida against British intrusion, end quote. Britain acted on a different vision of empire, quote, rooted in a fundamental belief about private property that shaped Anglo-American political identity, end quote. They acted on that view in two ways, establishing settlements of farmers and planters and engaging with indigenous people as trading partners, while simultaneously seeking to persuade them to relinquish their tribal lands to new settlers.
Connie, historians traditionally focused on the European actions and largely viewed native people as acted upon, not as actors in the struggles between empires. Modern historians recognize that they were quite adept at diplomacy and at playing one power against the other.
As Gallman explains, quote, by the middle of the 18th century, the Lower Creek tradition of persuasion and consensus sustained tension between and within their towns. Because it enabled the Lower Creeks to weigh their opportunities and risks, this tension supported their autonomy from each other and from Europeans, end quote. Even as they sought protection from the Carolina slave traders, they, quote, enacted a policy of political neutrality and ambivalence, taking advantage of both Spanish and British trade and diplomacy when it benefited them, end quote. Once the British gained control over East Florida in 1763 and the French were removed from the lower Mississippi region, Spanish claims shifted westward and the landscape for negotiation developed in new contexts. Britain became the lone power in the southeast region and moved to convert Indian land into British territory. With the previous balance of power destroyed, indigenous nations pushed back, most notably in what has been labeled as Pontiac's Rebellion. Lower Creeks and Seminoles in East Florida witnessed two important changes in their interactions with the British. No longer competing with the Spanish for native trade, British merchants raised prices, lowered quality, and engaged in abusive practices. In addition, pressure on the land increased. In response to violence in the West, the British government established a proclamation line at the crest of the Appalachians and forbade settlement west of the line. Although the settlers largely ignored the new border, East Florida now contained the largest amount of land east of the proclamation line and became, quote, a promising new source for British settlement, end quote. In 1765, British Governor James Grant met with Creek and Seminole leaders at Fort Picolata, a Spanish-built fort west of St. Augustine. The resulting treaty favored the British, with Creeks and Seminoles losing control over more than 2 million acres of land and ushering in, quote, the next era of European-native diplomatic relationships that emphasized land speculation most, trade and military alliances less, and Christian missionizing not at all, end quote. Although the British acquired the land they coveted, their efforts to establish a plantation economy largely failed. Gallman concludes, quote, the European policy of controlled inclusion gave way to a new policy of controlled exclusion. Familiar with generations of colonial experiences in North America, the British imported the force of its principles to the new colony of East Florida, where officials and planters gradually cleared the land of trees and native peoples and made room for the rise of a disruptive plantation economy. In the years to come, this economy would generate more disorder and change in this restless borderland. For the British Empire's loyal and rebellious subjects who contested it, the Spanish who coveted it, when they returned, the Africans who lost their lives to it, the native peoples who resisted it, and the new republicans who forced it into the realm of a new kind of empire, end quote.
Thank you, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. The Clearwater Lawn Bowling Club is celebrating their 100th anniversary. Holly Baker has more.
Richard Judicki is the vice president of the Clearwater Lawn Bowling Club. He recently talked with me about the club and its history. I asked him how he was first introduced to lawn bowling.
I had been a 10-pin bowler in Illinois, where I was brought up. And I did that for 50-some years, so I was used to that kind of bowling. When my wife and I decided to retire and move to Florida, she says, well, do you want to stay with your 10-pin bowling? I said, not really. I want to do something outside. My wife was on a bicycle ride along alternate 19, and she comes across a sign, and it says shuffleboard and lawn bowling. So she gets back home and she says, Dick, I think I've got a place I'd like you to look at. She says, well, it's lawn bowling. Now I think to myself, oh man, the only lawn bowling I've ever seen was 10 plastic pins and a little plastic bowl that you roll at them. It is an entirely different sport whatsoever. There are no pins you're aiming at. You aim at a small spherical white bowl called a jack.
Lawn bowling has a very long history. In 1299, a group of players in England organized the Southampton Bowling Green Club, the oldest bowling club in the world that's still active today. Lawn bowling was introduced to the American colonies in the early 1600s. A bowling green was established in Boston in 1615, and George Washington's father constructed a bowling green in Mount Vernon in 1732. The game lost popularity in the colonies during the American Revolution, as many things British, including lawn bowling, fell out of favor. Lawn bowling enjoyed a revival after a group of Scottish immigrants restored it in the late 19th century. In the early 20th century, lawn bowling clubs sprang up all over the United States. Several lawn bowling clubs were established in Florida in the 1920s, including the St. Petersburg Lawn Bowling Club, the Mount Dora Lawn Bowling Club, and the Clearwater Lawn Bowling Club.
We go back to our starting point, and we were one of the first of 20 clubs that was asked to join the American Lawn Bowls Association. We did get started in 1924, and it was through two Canadians who frequented Clearwater area for their winter solstice, so to speak, to get away from the cold weather. And they took a liking to it in Canada, and they went to the Chamber of Commerce in Clearwater and told them all about it. Man, wouldn't it be nice if you guys could help us get something going down here? And when they first started out, they were able to develop rinks, no clubhouse. They just had lockers that they could use down there. But rinks that are located on Pearson Osceola, which is where the old Public Works City Hall was that just got recently knocked down that the city of Clearwater had. In the 60s, that is when they decided we're going to build the city hall here. They said, all right, if you help us out a little bit with the money, we'll build you another place. And we now are located on Calumet, 1040 Calumet, which is the street just south of Sunset Park. And even though we say club, it is not a private club by any stretch of the imagination. We welcome anyone of pretty much any age. We're more than happy to give instructions to everybody.
The Clearwater Lawn Bowling Club currently hosts 5 tournaments a year. Members enjoy competing in tournaments such as the Southeast Division Tournament, the National Open Tournament, and the United States Singles and Pairs Championship.
We are the only club in the U.S. Bowls that has 7 Hall of Famers, the only club. And one of those Hall of Famers, Bill Miller, was also the world champion in singles, the world champion. And his son is still a member, and we bowl with him on occasion. He's a wonderful guy. He still has youth on his side, at least mentally. Physically, we're all slowing down a little bit, but that's why we'd like to get younger people involved. We want to see the club go on for many, many more years.
As the Clearwater Lawn Bowling Club celebrates a very important birthday in 2024, they're hoping to attract more players of all ages. Richard Udicki.
The most exciting thing, we will be celebrating our 100th anniversary, 100 years. We're going to have some special events, and we're going to try and get as much advertising out as we can. We sure would like the city's help with this because advertising costs money. Luckily, your show doesn't cost me anything or my club. I'm giddy. I'm just really happy about the whole thing, and it's a blast.
To learn more about the Clearwater Lawn Bowling Club, go to ClearwaterLawnBowlingClub.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and this week, Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.